Hello and welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Today I'm with novelist Hannah Jameson, who's written a book called The Last. One hotel, 20 survivors, and it starts off that John Keller was on a trip to Switzerland when the world ended. More than anything, he wishes he hadn't ignored his wife Nadia's last message. Hi, welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Hannah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is a bit dramatic, the world ending. Tell us about it. How does the world end?
Well, it's basically an outbreak, a sudden outbreak of nuclear war. Similar to what everyone's been joking about online in a very dark way since Trump got elected. He's a historian. He was on a conference. It's a hotel in the middle of nowhere. And when the bombs start dropping and everyone starts looking at their phones, that's all they know before the internet cuts out and communications go down.
So the idea is that he's in quite a remote place, so the nuclear whatever it is, waves haven't got to him, is that
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they're not in a blast radius.
You've really researched nuclear bombs.
I did research it a little bit, yeah. There's a very surprising website where you can basically, you can go online and you can test drop different existing weapons onto different cities. And you can see exactly what the blast radius would be if you drop it from different heights. And you can do things like change the weather and the wind speed so that you can see how radiation would travel sort of in the days and weeks afterwards. That's the kind of like really optimistic, happy research I was doing while writing this.
So he's there, he's cut off from his family. He doesn't know that the world's ended. How does he know that?
Well, basically the opening chapter of the book, the first sentence is that his wife Nadia always used to worry that she would find out about the end of the world through a phone notification. And I was really entertained by that idea, because if there was a breakdown in civilization, if nuclear war did break out, or if there was a plague, or any apocalyptic event, we would find out probably by just looking down at our phones. And I found that a really chilling prospect. So I imagine there would be a flurry of online activity.
So they would have seen a bomb's been dropped. And then, as you say, then the phones go dead, the internet goes dead.
Yeah.
And there's 20 people at this hotel. Mm-hmm. So how long are they in this hotel in the novel? How long does it last them being barricaded from the rest of the world? I mean, even though there's no world left. But
it's basically a couple of months later. Where they've been waiting for an evacuation that is essentially just never going to come.
How can the whole globe be wiped out then? Or are there pockets of survivors?
There would be pockets of survivors, definitely, for different amounts of time, depending on where the bombs dropped and like your proximity to the blast radius and stuff. But without the internet, like, how could you possibly know? Mm. Or if you had only sporadic communications, there would be very little way of knowing where was safe and where wasn't. Or like, if you had family in another country, you may not be able to contact them. So like part of the horror is just being completely cut off. We rely on the internet for absolutely everything. Yeah. And what if that just wasn't there one day?
Mm, fantastic. So being in a hotel's quite good because they've got food, haven't they? They've got tins and
pasta
and
rice. It's probably a pretty decent place to be, yeah. And they've got a fully stocked bar, which is what I would be doing in that situation. So yeah, it's probably a good place to be in terms of like what's stocked there, but then also you're there with a ton of other people who are just total wild cards who you don't know.
So are these people from the conference then?
A lot of his colleagues from the conference left because a lot of people would try and get to an airport. Against all public advice, they probably would try and get home. So a lot of people do leave, and the 20 that stay are the people who just think, I'm gonna hold tight and wait for police to arrive or something like that.
Anarchy has happened and there's no such thing as a police force.
So they're waiting for something, but they don't actually know what they're waiting for. They're just waiting for a sign or to be rescued.
Okay, so they're in a fearful state, and then something really dramatic happens.
Yes, basically the water starts running a bit cloudy and tastes a bit off. So in the opening chapters,
what time of year is it?
It's summer.
Okay, so there's no, you can't go melt some ice.
No, basically no. Yeah. So they go to the rooftop to check the water tanks with some hotel staff, and they discover the body of a young girl that was murdered and left in the water tank.
Do they know her? Do they recognise her?
None of them recognise her, no. She was probably a hotel guest, they speculate, but they don't actually know.
And is she from before or after the bomb?
Before.
Oh my God. Okay.
So yeah, that from that moment onwards, it's very easy for a small group in a confined space to descend into suspicion and paranoia. And that was what I wanted to do with the book.
Okay. So how could, imagining all this, how did it come along then? How many novels have you written? You're 28 years old. What's your kind of journey up till here?
This is my fourth novel. I've got three written previously in my early 20s, which were all part of the same series. They were very sort of more straightforward psychological crime thrillers, but set in London gangland from the point of view of the criminals, because that's always interested me more.
Really?
It's procedural. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were published when I was about 21, 22.
You say you dropped out of university to write.
I did, yeah.
So tell us that, because inspire people that are thinking, oh, I can't do my third year.
I'm not sure it's something I could advise anyone to do. But basically, I only enrolled at university because, ironically, I gave up on being published the first time. I didn't go to university out of college. I tried to get published for 3 years with the first draft of the book.
So how old were you then?
I was 18 when I left college. Okay. Yeah. I worked in the NHS for 3 years full time and just redrafted and, you know, redrafted. And then after 3 years, I thought, well, I kind of need a plan B because I can't do this forever. So I enrolled at Sussex Uni to do a degree in something that I was interested in, which was American history. And then literally weeks after I went to Brighton to start on my first year, I got signed by a literary agency completely by accident. I wasn't even sending the book out at the time, so that was a massive intervention from luck. And looking back, it is quite ridiculous.
So what happened from that moment?
I finished the book. I mean, I was only 30,000 words into a redraft when I was signed, but my first agent said that he would like to take it out to Frankfurt Book Fair. So I finished the book within a couple of months. It was an absurd schedule, but I managed to finish it. The book was taken out. I was offered a 3-book deal, which is, you know, the dream when you're 21 and you've wanted to be an author all your life. And I realised really quickly that there was no way I could do my degree full time and write 2 further books to contract. So I dropped out.
Wow. So you've been a writer since then?
Yes. I've only been a writer full time since last year, but that's just because it's so difficult to make money that you can live on from it.
I like the thing that you said, I've wanted to be a writer all my life. I'd like to know the actual moment, whatever age you were, that you decided that.
It was really young. I must have been about 6, maybe 7, but it was definitely when I was that young.
How did you get the idea?
Well, just writing and storytelling was just what I was good at. I mean, I was reading and writing way before I went to school, and reading way above my age level as well. And it never really occurred to me to be anything else. And no one ever told me that it was, well, no one ever told me until I was much older that it was a completely outlandish idea and not something you should realistically aspire to.
Good.
Very fortunate. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have tried.
Yeah, fantastic. So are you from a bookish household? Are your parents clever?
A pretty bookish household. Like, everyone reads. And my sister was also brought up a voracious reader. I don't even know if it's a case of being naturally smart. We would just always have books around, and
you had books in your bedroom. You were being read to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No, because I didn't have books.
Oh, really?
No, in my room. I only had things like The Cat in the Hat cookbook and They just didn't think that I was a, you know what I mean? I was just not classed as someone you gave books to in our family. You know, my elder sister was seen as clever. So
yeah.
I'm just saying that you're lucky.
Yeah.
That you had access to it and you know, you ate it up and you,
yeah.
it, you know, and it really did help.
Oh, absolutely. It's a massive privilege.
Yeah.
And especially because like our parents, like they had the time to read to us as well. And they,
yes.
So it's the time and the inclination.
Yeah. See, I wasn't read to either. So, you
yeah,
know,
I'm sure
difficult.
That makes a massive
yeah.
difference. Yeah.
yeah. But the only difference is since 13, I've become, as my husband said, an autodidactic, which means that I've read more classics than he has, you know,
because oh, really?
I never went to university. I've never been trained in anything. Anyone talking about me. Anyway, shouldn't be talking about me. Anyway, talking about the book. So the last, you say you've been talking about it quite a lot this month because it's being published tomorrow.
Yep, it's published tomorrow.
Tell me what the angle people are interested in mostly.
I think a lot of people are interested in it because of Donald Trump, to put it plainly, because a lot of people have been worrying about it in a way that I don't think they were necessarily worrying about it before. And, you know, even having like talk of nuclear war or nuclear missiles in the news, I don't think it's been that way for you know, what, since the 80s or something, the last time it was really permeating public discourse. So a lot of people are saying, oh, did you write it, you know, because it's actually about like what would happen with Donald Trump. And I made a point of not saying like how it actually panned out, because that's not the sort of judgment I want to make. I just wanted to channel a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety about where we are kind of as a species and, you know, where we might be going.
And yeah, and exactly. And where... Because you say, I mean, rely on the internet. I mean, even when I kind of go to the West End, and which I never used to think twice about, but now I'd sort of, to get from the tube to somewhere, I'll put it on Google Maps. It's
terrible. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and also I know I've got a niece who drives to work every day. Mm-hmm. She's been doing the job for 2 years, but she always puts on Google Maps. And someone said, do you know the way? And she said, well, I wouldn't do it without Google Maps, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it is unbelievable. And I do wonder how we ever used to get anywhere. Because when I was a teenager, I mean, Google Maps wasn't a thing. So.
Well, actually, you are, because you're 28. You remember before mobile phones.
Yeah.
What's your first kind of memory of computers coming in the house, mobile phones coming in, seeing your dad with one or your mum with one?
Well, my dad kind of works... was working with computers, I think, they were becoming a thing.
Wow, so that's good.
We had one in the house quite early, but it was one of those huge boxes,
yeah.
And it had that
dial-up
thing.
Yeah.
And if someone was on the landline, you had to like get off the internet. And that it seems so antiquated now, even talking about.
Yeah. It was sort of in the corner of the room, and it's like someone would occasionally go on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't like now, there'd be like five people in the house, everyone's got on
everyone's
their tablet
on their
or
laptop.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly what our house is like now.
Yeah.
Whereas before it was just, you'd go on it if you needed something specific.
Yeah.
And if we used the computer at school, that was always a big treat. It usually meant that we were playing some sort of educational game.
Yeah.
And now people just take laptops into lectures and stuff to take notes.
Do you remember mobile phones coming in?
Oh, just about. I got one really late, though.
How old were you then?
I don't know. I must have been about 14 or something.
Don't you call
like
that late?
Is it quite late?
I was 40.
Really?
Well, yeah, because I'm 55 now. Well, no, I was probably... I remember my husband telling me how to work it. I said, well, what? He said, you've got to have it on all the time. I went, what? He said, and you've got to have it by you. I said, I've got to have it on all the time. I didn't understand that phones had to be... I mean, it's incredible. I had to be taught.
Yeah.
And now when I meet someone who's like in their 80s or something, you've got to say, actually... Because I've been said to them, you've got to have it on all the time. But they say, I only turn it on for emergencies. And that's how they think of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
In a way, I quite envy it. Because like there used to be times where people just couldn't reach you.
Yes.
And now like you're just, you know, everyone's got their phone in their hand all the time. And there's people know you have as well. So the onus to like react instantly to every message and every email, it's quite high pressure.
Do you have kind of days when you don't turn on your phone? Or what happens when you're writing? I mean, do you turn off the Wi-Fi on your computer when you're writing? Otherwise, emails are coming in.
No, I don't. I don't have the self-control.
Wow.
I'm a compulsive checker of email and Twitter.
But how can you concentrate then?
In a way, like I've noticed that the the days where I get most writing done are the days I post most on Twitter. And it's because I'm just in this state of activity where my brain is coming up with words and they're going onto the page. But then there's a part of my brain which is like a little child that just needs distracting all the time. And if it's not adequately distracted by music, then I just go to Twitter and like fire something off, and then I go back to the book, and then I go to
something else. So your brains are completely different than our, you know, my generation's brains, because my son is exactly the same. He has to have music when he's studying.
Yeah.
Otherwise he cannot study. He also says he's got a problem. He can't watch a whole film, a whole movie. He says he hasn't got the concentration. And if we do watch one, he's looking up on Wikipedia all the time, every actor in it. Can you relate to that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely how me and my sister have come to consume movies, definitely. I watch TV shows because they're easier to have on in the background. Like films
background,
I really
you see,
struggle.
You see it as a back...
Yeah, I know.
You see it as... It's so weird for us that you see it as a background thing.
Yeah, they're always... I don't know what it is.
Well, you're seeing that the internet's number one and film and TV is in the background.
Yeah, or at least they're all competing for equal attention. Mm. So I'll be half watching a TV show, but then I'll half be doing something else.
See, whereas I put my phone onto airplane mode at 6 o'clock in the evening.
Oh, I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, because I just don't want to see... I don't want blue light. I don't want to be hurt. I don't want to be contacted.
Yeah.
You know.
I think that would be great. I'm really trying at the moment, because I know it affects sleep so badly, to just cut the internet off in the evening and just spend it reading.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's just something about the glare. By the
you know,
time
you
I
can
bed,
even
I'm
buy
tired.
These blue light glasses.
God, really?
Yeah, which would probably... I've read kind of health... nuts, I suppose they're called, they buy them and they wear them so that they can, you know, you can look at the internet. But also they say when you're travelling things, you get glare. Because I was on an aeroplane the other day and everyone's got screens looking at films and things. And I was thinking, I just don't want this. I'd love to put on some blue glare glasses then, because I don't want their screens in my head.
Yeah.
You know?
I suppose it's like when you're in the cinema and someone turns their phone on and then that tiny light is all you can see. Even though you've got this huge screen, if someone's got their phone on, you're like, oh my God, turn it off. It's all like an...
It's awful.
It's just dragging attention.
But also I hate the sound of people eating and drinking.
Yeah, basically everything everyone does in a cinema is annoying to some degree. I even like, I was in the cinema with my friends the other day and like one of them just took out her phone to check her text and I was like, turn it off. Like
she's
my best friend. And I was just like, I'm sorry, I've got to shout at you.
Yeah.
Because that's unacceptable.
What were you watching?
Oh God, what was it? I think it was The Favourite.
Yes. Did you like it?
I loved it. I thought it was amazing.
What did you like about it?
I loved how like filthy and modern it was.
But you know, that isn't modern.
I
Saying
guess,
yeah. Construct, which is one of the things they say in it, is a totally 16th century term.
Yeah.
And they were bawdy, you see. Yeah. We, because of Victorians happening in between, we've all become much more polite, you see. But actually they used to, you know, a woman would call it a cunt and you know what I mean? And just words, it was like they were, more bawdy than us and more upfront than us. So you think that it's modern, but actually we are kind of more old-fashioned in the way that we're more polite.
Yeah, that's true. And we probably police our language a little bit more than they ever used to.
Yeah,
I thought it was a really interesting clash, though. Like, you know, the dance scene where he's doing, like, break dancing and stuff. I thought it was amazing.
See, I didn't see it as that.
Really?
Yeah. I just saw it as that was the way they danced
probably
then.
Probably how they danced at the time. Yeah. I'd love it. Like, honestly, if that were the case, and it might well have been, I just think that's fantastic.
I just think it'd be so good if people... still had to learn to dance, because I think it's the kind of opposite of mobile phones, isn't it? You are touching each other, you're looking in each other's eyes, you're doing something together, you know. And it was the only way you could sort of communicate with someone of the other sex, because you don't have a chaperone or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, this was the dance, you know, someone was telling me that the reason people waltz was so, you know, waltzing in Victorian times was so outrageous, was that men would have an erection. And they would, and that's why it was seen as outrageous. And that was the way of a man telling the woman that they fancied them. So they'd feel their erection against them. So we all think that, you know, in those times they didn't do this and that. It was just suggested in a different way than us. Whereas now, I want to ask you, being 28, how do you date?
How do you date?
Does a man ever flirt with you? Do you ever flirt with a man in public? Would that happen?
Oh, God. I mean, oh, that's a whole can of worms. I actually don't date. I haven't dated for a few years.
Why? You put off it?
I kind of can't stand it. And it sounds really like old-fashioned to blame the apps, but I think the apps have made it way more stressful and kind of a much worse experience. Because the friends of mine who do use Tinder and stuff to try and hook up with people, like, they're looking for the next person within a few days. Even if they're enjoying themselves, there's this pressure to be like, well, I could just find someone better, or I could just go on to the next person.
I could have better sex.
Exactly.
And it's like, the next guy might have a better six pack.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, I want to be wooed, damn it. Like, I want you to put some effort in and some investment. And I think that's really hard to find.
Because now, where would you go to meet young people at 28? Where would you go?
God, no. Probably like just a bar or a club or something. But then if you're in a club, you don't hear people anyway. And I think it's become a lot harder. And dates are so informal now. It's not a case of you go somewhere nice and like you talk to each other. It's just, oh, let's hang out.
I think that's the trouble. My friend Donna, who I do Radio Gorgeous with, very much when I was young, it was like you'd meet down the pub, you know, yeah. That was how, and then a man would take you to the pub, and it was never that formal, you know what I mean? It was just the way, because she said she thinks that's what the British are like, whereas the Americans, we didn't even say the word date, you'd say, oh, are you going out with him? Is he taking you out? Because date's an American word, it's just come in the last few years. So dating in America is... the man will take you on two or three dates, and by the third date, you're pretty much expected, you know, sex.
Put out, yeah.
But what I mean is that it's like there is a formulaic pattern.
Yeah.
Whereas I think we're much more sort of a group. We're more like, oh, I'll bump into you in the pub, or I'll see you down the gig, or... I think we're more casual, actually, the British.
I think that's really true. My American friend who lived in the UK for a while, she said that trying to date British guys was an absolute nightmare because she could never tell if they liked her or not. And she was like, you know, she wasn't bigging up American guys by any means. But she said that dating British guys, she said it's just so casual. And she was like, in America, they would say, let's go out to dinner, and it's a date, and it would be referred to as, you know, a kind of courtship. And, you know, not that she said it was better or worse, but she just said it was slightly less stressful.
Yes, yes, yes. Because I think the trouble with your age is you don't know where you're at with a man now, because they're not allowed to kind of flirt with you. They're not meant to touch you, and you know, like it must be difficult.
Yeah, I think I'm not even sure if it's maybe it is a generational thing, but people are really averse to just saying what they want. I think if people were way more upfront and just said, I'm looking for something casual, let's hook up and like have some sex, or like I'm looking for a relationship, it would save everyone a lot of bother, because then you would just know where you are with everyone all the time. But there's a real fear of expressing how you feel or what you want.
Which is the absolute opposite of what you think that good communications, which is the world that we're in now with, you know, all these messages, you can't stop talking to people.
Yeah.
Why can't you say why can't you be honest?
Exactly. Instead of like a competition to see who can act like they care less. And it's so tiresome. I can't.
So let's come back to your book, The Last. I suppose the thing is, 20 people in this scenario, it's so intense. They haven't got the mobiles. They've got to start being honest with each other.
Yeah, and that's that was something really interesting to explore. Like, I love the dynamics of small groups anyway. And if there's an element of claustrophobia to it, that's even more interesting. And one of my favourite things about writing The Last was all of the characters' backstories and motivations and the things that they're scared of and the way that they're reacting to loss, because, you know, it's a grieving process for all of them as well. You know, they've lost their whole previous lives and now they're having to build something else. And that affects different people in different ways. So in terms of like the psychology of it, it was really fascinating to watch all the characters like cope with it in different ways.
And how did you develop them? Did you develop them before you wrote it, or did they kind of develop as you wrote it?
They always, characters always kind of show themselves to me, and it's always through the process of writing. I can come up with a kind of vague outline of a character, what they do you know, what their tone is and maybe how they talk, but everything else is shown to me through exploring.
So they get into your head and they become a voice, which isn't you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And with John, that was particularly interesting because I didn't know everything about John, the protagonist, until I started writing from his perspective. And there were parts of him that just really irritated me, and I didn't agree with so much of like how he thought, and But, you know, he was really interesting to me. By the end, like, he was so human and well-rounded. But
so is he American?
Yes, he's an American character.
So why are you interested in America particularly, do you think?
Well, I've always been interested in history. And American history is such a, like, modern American history is such a circus. And it's so compressed into, like, the last 200-300 years in a way that, you know, studying British history, it goes back so much further. And everything they have done at breakneck speed, you know, we took, like, centuries to get to. So yeah, I think just for sheer entertainment value, US history is particularly fascinating to me.
So do you watch any background TV? I know you call it back. Do you watch any TV? What's your American favourite programmes then out there?
Ooh, well, I've got a few. My favourite TV shows are probably Justified and The Leftovers.
Okay, I've never heard of either of them.
Very different in tone, but Justified's basically a modern Western set in Kentucky. It's in Harlan County. And it's the story of a US Marshal trying to break up a drug ring, but it's him going back to where he grew up. And I love that kind of modern cowboy aesthetic. And I've always really kind of loved Westerns.
Oh, you're a cowgirl.
Yeah.
You need to get... That's where you should go. Go and find a cowboy.
I should, yeah. I've always thought, yeah. I just wanna ride off on a horse. And that's pretty much how I wanna spend my time, on a ranch with some dogs and
fabulous
horses.
And writing. And what's the other programme or Netflix you like then?
Oh, The Leftovers. Mm. It was a big influence on The Last, to be honest. Because it's a TV show about a cataclysmic event called The Departure. And it's basically like 3% of the world's population vanishes one day. And the TV show is set a couple of years later. And it's just about how humanity deals with something unexplainable happening. So people have lost family members, people might know someone who's vanished, but they don't know why. And of course, religious organizations are in turmoil because some think it's the rapture and some don't. People are arguing about whether, you know, these people are in heaven or if they still exist at all. And it's about how civilization breaks down when all of our belief systems do. And it's a really, really amazing show. It's got Justin Theroux in it and Christopher Eccleston, and it's some of the best performances of their careers.
Fantastic. So The Last is like a kind of microscope kind of view of what would happen at the end of the world.
Yeah.
You've got all the different characters in it.
I wanted to explore people's reactions to like extreme loss and extreme change. Like that's very interesting to me.
Thank you so much, Hannah Jameson, coming from Kew today onto Radio Gorgeous. It's been really, really interesting talking to you. And masses of luck tomorrow with your publishing date. What are you doing for you? Are you having a party or anything, or a book launch?
The book launch is Friday. I haven't got anything planned for tomorrow at all. So I'm probably just going to take myself out for breakfast and then work all day as usual.
Lovely. So thank you very, very much for coming onto Radio Gorgeous.
All right, thank you.
So The Last, One Hotel, 20 Survivors by Hannah, without an H on the end, Jameson, like the whiskey, is published by Viking, which is an imprint of Penguin Books. You can always find fascinating women on Radio Gorgeous.